to the 218th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I am your host. I am a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Thank you, and welcome. It's a busy summer. I've just finished with our Level 3 nutrition class. If you missed it today, Level 3 students, you missed a good one. We made grandma's stuffed shells with a spinach tofu stuffing. And the Delaney Ladies' homemade tomato sauce. So it was a good one. I plan on imbibing in some of those this evening and dinner. In case you didn't know it, we'll just jump right into it. The dietitian, my mother, the diva, and I have released a cookbook, Plant-Based Wellness Cookbook, Three Generations of Cooking. You can get it from our website. You can get it from Amazon. You can ask your local bookstore to order it from Ingram Sparks. It's available all those places. So get one, share it with your friends, have a cooking competition. One of the nice things I heard today was one of my members has a company, and typically he gets derailed with his nutrition because reps are always bringing in greasy food for lunch. And so he bought one of the cookbooks, and once a week minimum they have to, somebody makes a dish from the cookbook so they can share, so there's always something good to eat. So that's I thought that was a cool way to utilize the cookbook if you have an office. Obviously, there's, you know, if you're in a nurse's station and people are always bringing oily, fatty desserts, you know, there's some banana bread in there. There's some lemon blueberry muffins. There's some things that you can share to bring with work that are, again, oil and sugar free, safe for everybody to have as a treat, you know, on a Friday or whatever. And certainly you can bring a lot of the dishes for lunch. You can make a big pot, bowl of cowboy caviar and share it with your friends. So lots of ideas that you can make and share at either potlucks or cookouts or even at work. So check that out. I'm going to be doing some book signings. The next one is July 23rd, which is next week up in Venice, Florida at your local meetup group. So you can go to meetup.com and find the plant-based meetup group in Venice. July 31st, I'm going to be at the Life Care Center in Punta Gorda. It's a rehabilitation center. Or we'll be doing a book signing there. They are giving the first 20 people a free book, so get in line and get your book. October 21st, I'm going to be at Copperfish Bookstore in Punta Gorda doing a signing, and we'll have some hors d'oeuvres and demo. And August the 27th, I'll be at Naples Green Scene, Naples, Florida. Too bad it's not Naples, Italy, but it's Naples, Florida, at their potluck, and I'll be doing a book signing. So a lot of good things going on. Next week, the dietitian, Eddie Delaney Minert, and I will be at the Committee for Responsible Medicine conference in Washington, D.C. So if any of you are going to be there, stop and grab me and say hi. I'll probably sneak a few cookbooks into my suitcase if somebody wants to get an autographed book, so it could happen. So yeah, things have been going good. Training for Ironman Chattanooga, which is coming up at the end of September, so swimming, biking, and running in the heat. A little cross training with yard work, so it's all good. Practicing my breathing training. By breathing through my nose during training, it's helping to keep my heart rate down, deliver more oxygen to my tissues, decrease glucose utilization, increase fat utilization, and feel better in general. So that's really going well. I use a Zwift trainer, Wahoo trainer, the Zwift app, not sponsored by them. To do my during the week hill sessions, because we're living in Florida where there's no hill. We also call hill training wind training, because when you ride into continuous windy conditions, you're getting some, there's never a break in pedaling, so that's a bit of resistance training as well. If you are a cyclist and are listening to the Tour de France, or watching the Tour de France, I should say, there's a big hubbub about ketone esters, and you know, everybody's running out to get them. Apparently you can buy them on Amazon. The question is whether or not teams that use the ketone esters have an advantage. Of course, anybody can use them if they want to. but the Dutch pro cycling team Jumbo-Visma used him and two of their guys. Of course, they won the team time trial, and Mike Tunesen, I'm going to botch all these names, and Dylan Groenewegen both won stages, and so they were apparently using the ketone esters. Team Lotto also apparently is using them, and so the question is, does this help them or not? And what is a ketone? And of course, the big hubbub about, you know, ketosis and the keto diet, and how does all this go together? Ketone esters are, you know, if you remember your organic chemistry, esters bind to an alcohol molecule to make a ketone body. So ketone esters are now being developed that are available orally so that they can be converted into ketone bodies. Typically, you have to be starving to make ketones or in a state of ketosis with a high-fat diet and not taking in or very, very, very little carbohydrate. Well, that's not intuitive if you're going to be doing an endurance event because your muscles utilize glucose first primarily, or they prefer the preferred fuel of choice. Certainly like to use fat as well on a slower, so for a slower burn. So if you use all your glucose, then you have to replace it. So you take in glucose typically while you're eating. So you see the guys with their feed sacks getting the energy bars that are, you know, high glucose, or some sort of multidextrin or sucrose that can be broken down and used for fuel. So you'd like your body to be able to burn fat, but when these guys are exercising at a really high rate, they're burning a tremendous amount of glucose. So the thought is that if you can give them ketone bodies and they still have their glucose on board, that they can use the ketone bodies or metabolize first, and they're sparing some glucose. There is also a little bit of evidence that you might decrease lactic acid in the system, and that might help out a little bit. The story of keto esters goes back several years. They were actually used by Sky Cycling Team in the 2012 Olympics, but they were first developed per the U.S. United States Army. We're looking for a source of energy that wouldn't spoil in hot environments. So they gave $10 million to a group at Oxford and Harvard, and to come up with an oral form of ketone esters that could be used. And the military subsequently dropped the idea, but Kieran Clark invented these ketones that can be taken in and used with patients and athletes. So that's really where the testing started. They looked at rowers, and they first did the studies are very, very limited. There's a lot of companies out there picking them up now. The patent's been sold, but there's not a lot of scientific evidence. One study, one of the original studies, 18 people, they divided them in two groups. That means nine rowers in each group. They did 3 weeks of endurance training, and then they looked at their power on a maximal rowing stress test. And the ketone group power was at best 15, or at the minimal 15% higher in the last 2 hours of the training session. He's like, well, big whoop, you know, that's just not like certainly a breakthrough. It's not like EPO or something. But if you're looking at Olympic athletes, a little bit might go a long way, perhaps. Their maximum heart rate at the time of fatigue was a little bit lower, which means that, again, you could utilize more fat, which might be beneficial. They also had decrease in GDF-15 hormone, which is a marker of overtraining. So, so there was a little bit of evidence in 2016 in the Journal of Cell Metabolism. They thought that, again, that the ketosis alters a fuel preference so that, again, if you're exercising at a high intensity, you're going to be burning glucose. But if you give somebody ketone bodies or the ketone esters, they might use them first and save a little glucose for later. the benefit was, looking at about 3% benefit at max. In 2008, the ketones, they were sold to a company, HVMN. They're FDA approved as a food, not a drug. Of course, there's no regulation on the amounts in the pill. Ketosis does decrease muscle glycolysis and lactate concentration, so that thought of maybe that is good. But again, typically, people get ketone bodies when they're starving, and you don't want to starve somebody if they're trying to exercise at a maximal capacity. But again, if you can hold on to carbohydrates, then that would be good. Again, there's a lot not known. One of the biggest quotes is, no one knows which ketone bodies regulate skeletal muscle bioenergetics and substrate metabolism. So again, there's a lot of speculation that it might help. They didn't really look at whether you gave somebody ketone bodies or a little bit extra glucose. Would that really make a difference? It comes down to, if anybody's done an endurance event, it's also being able to tolerate the food itself. Some people can't take in a lot of carbohydrate. The question would come if people try to take in more of these ketone esters, would they actually get nauseated as well? So it may decrease their ability to actually take them in. But, there might be a little bit less fatigue. People look to lactic acid as a bad thing. And lactate is really not what causes a decrease in the pH in the blood anyway. But there is a study that looked at hand grip and lactic acid production. And, there's a thought on central governing theory where the lactic acid buildup doesn't cause muscle fatigue, but it may cause your brain to perceive that there's impending doom and you slow down. There's a guy named Tim Noakes that's written some things, a physician, researcher, and the theory is that the decreased pH in the brain might actually cause some of the impending doom, stop what you're doing, as opposed to lactic acid in the muscle causing any problems. Lactic acid was first discovered in 1869 by isolating acid in sour milk. That's how it got its name, lactic acid. And there was actually a Nobel Prize given to Hill and Meyerhoff when they figured out that it was a reaction in glycolysis of basically splitting sugar in the absence of oxygen. But acidosis is actually caused by when you use energy or ATP, you generate inorganic phosphate and hydrogen ion, and that's really what causes the buildup of hydrogen ions that are free below to drop your pH below 7, and that's typically what causes problems and causes you to slow down. So as long as you can, again, continue to meet your ATP or energy demands, then everything's okay. But when you can't, you start to accumulate these proteins. There are these protons. This is all done in the mitochondria of the muscle cells. So the more mitochondria you have by exercising and the more efficient that they work, the better off you are. It also goes back to breathing. The more you can decrease your sympathetic tone and decrease your adrenaline, the better your mitochondria work, the least decrease in acidosis and accumulation as well. So lactate actually retards acidosis in the system, and it buffers. It can be used as a form of energy. So, it's not all bad, is what people, are the people that make supplements to decrease your lactic acid. So, all this stuff you have to take with a grain of salt, so to speak. Interestingly, fast twitch muscles use more glucose and have lower numbers of mitochondria. And again, when you endurance train and build more endurance, you're actually building more mitochondria. And when your breathing is improved, you provide more oxygen to those mitochondria, which results in better metabolism. When you have faster breathing and mouth breathing, you're more sympathetic driven and you have more adrenaline, and you actually decrease the clearance of lactate from these exercise muscles as well as resting muscles. So again, you know, back to this breathing things, we want to be able to have gears that when we're at rest, you know, we're very parasympathetically leaning. So we have decreased inflammation, decreased heart rate, decreased blood pressure. And then when you start to exercise, you have multiple gears before you're in high gear. You don't want to be spending your resting periods, you know, in this highly sympathetic state. And then when you go to exercise, one, you're not using oxygen effectively, but you really don't have anywhere to go. It's like starting a car out in fourth gear. It's hard to get started, and you don't have much to go before you run out of gears. But I thought it was funny, you know, we're looking at, you know, getting ready to do this Ironman Chattanooga, and when you get to Ironman or any kind of marathon or endurance event, they always have an expo, and at the expo, they always have people selling things to improve your performance. And people that are seasoned athletes will tell people that, you know, that's their first event, don't try anything new before a race. Don't try new socks, new clothes. Don't try a new supplement. Don't try a new drink. Don't eat something new before the race 24 hours because it can take everything you've trained for and throw it on its ear. But when people go to the expos, they see things. It's like, well, maybe the seat will make me feel better. Maybe these pedals that weigh, you know, 200 grams less will make me ride faster. Maybe these deep dish wheels will help. If it's a marathon, you know, the new thing that's a carbon foot plate in the shoes will make me run faster. I should take caffeine. The reality of it is, if you, you know, to get the effects of a lot of these things, you have to be a quite accomplished athlete. So the carbon plate shoes for somebody that runs an 11-minute pace, they're probably not going to get the maximum out of that. They might even hurt their feet more. So somebody that's inefficient, lands on their heels, and they use these shoes, they're not going to get the benefits out of them. The ketone esters, again, if somebody's not functioning on a high level of metabolism to begin with, they're probably going to be using so much glucose anyway that it's not going to make a difference, and they're not going to see that 3%. And that's where they think about the carbon plate shoes come into, about 2 or 3%. Caffeine's another substance. I had somebody ask me about, you know, what do I think about caffeine? Caffeine can increase your heart rate, can increase your sympathetic drive. So that wouldn't be so great if your heart rate starts to go up. But it can also decrease your perception of exertion. So you don't think things are as bad as they are. So it gives people a sense of everything's okay, and you can push a little harder, so it probably negates the bad things that happen. The other thing that can make probably the most difference is weight loss. If you have a person that's you know, going to run a 4-hour marathon time, and you shave 2 pounds off of them, you'll save about 3 minutes. If you gain a couple pounds, you're going to gain 3 minutes. If you lose 4 pounds, maybe about 6 minutes. And they've actually done the calculations. There are pace calculators, but if you lose 6 pounds, you might shave almost 10 minutes off your time. So that's actually a much better deal than buying something that might make you sick at your stomach or shoes that might be too stiff for you. So a little weight loss and a little extra training, probably breath training, to decrease your resting heart rate and decrease and improve the oxygen delivery to your tissues. And a little weight loss before a race would result in the safest way to improve your performance. I'd like to do a shout out to Debbie Dendinger and Cheryl Mizluski. I'm going to butcher your name, Cheryl, but you know who you are. They're always driving up to nutrition class and driving back, and so they have me in their ear going and coming. So thanks for showing up today and sharing, Chels. And a shout out to Sherry White, who sent the question in. So thank you know everybody for listening and tuning in. Sometimes I think I'm just sitting here with the cat or the dog or in a room talking by myself and not sure anybody's listening, but I have been getting a lot of nice feedback lately, so thank you all for that. One last thought about caffeine. You know, if the question is, what are you taking it for in the first place? You know, if you're taking it to perform better in an endurance event, you know, like I said, it might end up being a wash, or if it makes you feel better, then, you know, perhaps a little bit of an advantage that the pain doesn't quite hurt as much. I know if you're somebody that uses caffeine on a regular basis and use it during a race, it might not have quite as big of effect. Also, if you use a lot in a race, it could really linger on for the next day or so as far as having trouble sleeping. If you're somebody that takes a lot of caffeine to stay awake during the day, it may be such that you need to look at your diet or get more sleep, because that's really not what you're, you know, the caffeine's going to, that's what you're not looking for that. That's not going to improve your overall health and wellness. You need to get your rest and not need a stimulant to stay awake or to improve your performance at work. Again, I would look to, you know, your breathing and, again, rest and exercise and your nutrition as far as that goes. If you're somebody that just likes coffee and tea, there's not a lot of downside to having a cup of coffee or a cup of tea. Green tea is probably going to provide you with more antioxidants. We know that coffee beans also, though, do contain polyphenols and antioxidants as well. If you filter the coffee, that'll take out some of the fat from the bean or the oil from itself. So people have that drank a lot of coffee can theoretically raise their cholesterol. If you have a history of arrhythmias, then excess caffeine might make those worse. Not in everybody, but they can. So those are all, you know, it's pretty individual as far as, you know, what you're looking for. But as far as sugary energy drinks with a lot of caffeine or these 12-hour energies, I would stay away from it because it's not really what you're after. You know, that's certainly not the way you want to get your improved performance. I had somebody talk about that they were very stressed and they particularly were stressed at the end of the day. And I then asked them, well, what are you having for dinner this evening? And we were talking about 1:30 in the afternoon. She said, I don't know. And we have to make so many decisions throughout the day if you're trying to become plant-based and eat more healthy, but you don't know what you're going to eat till, you know, an hour before you need to make dinner or go to the store to buy dinner. That's going to add a tremendous amount of stress, because you have to get it and prepare it and look things up if you don't have something, you know, on hand. That's why I suggest that people have their go-to meals or things that they really like, and maybe have one or two or three go-to meals during the week. So there are things you know how to make already. You don't need a recipe. You may keep most of those ingredients on hand so that your weekly trip to the grocery store to, you know, just to stock up on greens and vegetables, you know, you'll end up having everything to make most of those go-to meals. And it takes a lot of stress. And just, you know, jotting down 2 or 3 days of what you like to eat. We typically eat soup 1 or 2 times a week, which can be repurposed for lunch or dinner, you know, one of the other days. So it makes it easy. Again, you can take soup, put it over potatoes, soup, put it over greens. So, you know, those are ways to make your life a lot less stressful. I had somebody else talk to me about, you know, they've been derailed by having to go to weddings and baby showers and get-togethers in this summer. You know, I can't say that I would ever get derailed at one of those events, because it's just not an option. Most of the time, if it's a family and a family member that's getting married, and there's always you know, you can ask them, you know, can the hotel or the catering service, you know, do a vegan option for me? There's always the opportunity to eat before and after, so I wouldn't worry with it. To me, baby shower cake is off limits because it's oil, butter, and fat and sugar that I don't want. It's not part of what I eat, doesn't serve me well. And I'm happy to watch somebody else if that's how they get their jollies, but I'm not interested in eating that. Addie Delaney Meinert, when she had her wedding, she had fully vegan wedding. We didn't make a big deal out of it, but it was at a university facility, and they were used to a lot of ethnic cooking and different ways of cooking. They did a fabulous job at making plant-based food without oil or salt. We didn't advertise it, but it was that way. And we had a baker make a wedding cake that was plant-based and, you know, did a very good job. So if you're planning an event, you certainly can do it. You don't have to throw it in your people's face that it's vegan or plant-based. You can just simply have, you know, a buffet with grilled vegetables and pasta and rice and beans and all kinds of different salads, then people, you know, they're not going for the food. If they're going for the food, they're going for the wrong reason. But if I, you know, was going to an event that I didn't have any control over and there wasn't anything there that I could eat, you know, again, I just would defer for those couple of hours and, you know, happy cow my way into a restaurant afterwards and find something to eat. So, I wouldn't, you know, those kind of things, you just sort of have to figure that you're probably not going to have an opportunity to have something to eat, so eat beforehand so you're not starved, you know, you might be able to get a salad or something while you're there, and then just don't worry about it. Have a great time celebrating whatever's going on, but don't worry about, you know, what you're eating, and if you're asked, then you can just say, you know, there's nothing here that... you know, that I feel is healthy enough for me to eat and call it a day. As you know, I'm training for Ironman Chattanooga, and there's swimming and there's biking and there's running, and triathlon started with people arguing over which was the best exercise. Was it swimming, biking, or running? Who was the toughest athlete? And the first triathlon was basically to see, you know, if people could do all three disciplines and which one was the hardest. And, you know, if you're a swimmer, probably the running is going to be the hardest. And if you're a runner, the swimming might be the hardest. And if you're a biker, both could be hardest, or both could be harder. Just depends. But there was a study published in Frontiers in Physiology, Exercise Phys Journal, looking at the left ventricular structure and function in elite swimmers and runners, and basically looking to see, you know, is there a heart that functions better than others? And, you know, it comes down to training. When you're swimming, especially freestyle, well, in any kind of swimming, you're going to be supine and you're going to be in the water. So there's going to be an impact from the pressure of the water into the return of blood to your heart. There's also the change in, you know, you're laying down as opposed to standing up. So the blood return is also changed that way as opposed to standing up. And what they noticed is that, you know, typically hearts of athletes become thicker, just like a muscle, any other muscle would become thicker. Typically blood vessels dilate as well. And there's more mitochondria. So hearts are bigger, thicker, and more efficient, as opposed to a thick heart that's a sick heart with small blood vessels and decreased blood flow that makes it more difficult. There are conditions called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy where the muscle becomes abnormally thick and the muscle fibers are actually laid kind of in a disarray, so to speak. And so that function of that heart is not as good. Those fibers don't work together. There can be very forceful beat at first and it doesn't relax, but over time, that muscle starts to fail. So the question has always been, well, is an athletic heart going to be a heart that's prone to bad things happening later on in life? There's, we've talked about on the podcast before, there's some association with atrial fibrillation in elite athletes later on or more high volume, high heart rate athletes later on. And, you know, it's multifactorial. Certainly the heart stretch and the high sympathetic tone, there's probably also a genetic component. Perhaps there's also a breathing component to it. People that, again, live on this high sympathetic tone, there's the scale towards the high sympathetic activity, depending on their training, the recovery, all plays a role in their risk in the future. But if you just look at the heart size, you know, that hypertrophied muscle is perfectly normal. We see the heart rate is very efficient. It differs a little bit when we look at the cardiac output, which is how much blood comes out with each beat. That's a product of the amount that the heart can squeeze or the stroke volume that it can squeeze out and the heart rate. So if somebody squeezes out a little bit of blood with each beat, but they have a high heart rate, as opposed to somebody squeezes out a lot of blood and a high heart rate, so that all that's all different. But athletes tend to have a higher cardiac output than non-athletes. And in swimmers and runners, it varies a little bit more. The stroke volume might be a little bit more in swimmers. The relaxation of the heart to allow it to fill with blood is a little bit better and quicker in endurance and in runners. And the way the heart actually contracts and kind of spins on its axis, you know, the heart is a sphere, and it contracts more of a, as a, you know, if you wring out a wash rag, wring out a sponge, this twisting type of motion as it contracts. And so that's a little bit better in runners than in swimmers. And the question is, if the relaxation better, it probably has to do with the way the heart fills with blood and the relaxation. Runners have a little bit less time, you know, more turnover, than swimmers as far as a better filling because of being horizontal. So, you know, it works out different for the different sports, but it doesn't make it better or worse. It's certainly interesting, but I don't think that one person, you know, a swimmer or a runner has a better heart or less problems later in life. I think both exercises are wonderful, and, you know, nobody should switch to one or the other just because of they're afraid of what it's going to do to their heart. I will say that, you know, swimmers need to do weight-bearing exercise because it's not a weight-bearing exercise. Even people that do aerobics need to, you know, do weight-bearing exercises to keep their bone strong. Most elite swimmers do a lot of weight training anyway, even more so than runners. Elite long-distance runners probably don't do that much weight training. But again, they're doing a lot of pounding, so you know it all works out as far as the bone strength. We get people coming in all the time to sign up for the practice, and it's different. My traditional cardiology practice a year and a half ago, I got referrals from people needed a cardiologist, so either their primary care would send them to me or their insurance company would say, yeah, I'm on the list, or their friends would say, hey, go see her, and that's how patients would come to the office. And they may or may not have wanted to do anything about their heart disease as far as them personally. They might have been fine with medications or a procedure. Certainly, over the last 5 years, I've tried my very best to get anybody that walks through the door to become plant-based. But the practice now lends itself to people that actually want to be healthy. And so I'm often hearing stories when people come in that their doctor just wanted to put them straight away on medications and they didn't really want to do it. Or they went in for a stress test and ended up on a bypass table and then ended up with, you know, a different surgery and then ended up and nobody took any time. And there was a person today that they had decided after their bypass to become plant-based, and they, you know, did their diligent work and watched the documentaries and read the books and became plant-based. And of course they lost a lot of weight and they're exercising and their blood pressure's going down, and now the guy's dizzy. And he's dizzy because he's on a bunch of diuretics. So when he weighed 40 or 50 pounds more, and he was eating a high salt diet, it was one thing, but nobody wants to stop the medications because people just can't fathom, healthcare providers can't fathom that somebody could get off their medications. And we really do need, you know, in some instances, there are medications that are needed. This atrial fibrillation, people need to have the rate control or they can go into heart failure. You need to be covered with a blood thinner if you have this arrhythmia that is and it's persistent. It certainly decreases the risk of stroke. That being said, all medications are not equal. There are medications with a lot of side effects, and as people get older and get put on multiple medications, some of these medications interact and can cause more side effects, and then you have more disease and more illness. So, you know, you deserve to ask questions to your healthcare provider, and if you can't, then you need to move on. You deserve to have your time and have somebody take time and answer the questions and look at your medications and see whether or not that something could be discontinued. You know, I think it's everybody, you know, even though your insurance is so-called paying the bill, you as a consumer can choose, you know, whose threshold you want to cross. So you deserve to be able to ask as many questions as you want. You deserve to know why that you're on a particular medication and is there an alternative. And you deserve to be able to decline a medication, you know, if it's causing a significant side effect. But you should be educated on what the possible consequence of stopping one of these medications could be. You know, certainly an arrhythmia medication, you may need a substitute. Just stopping a medication may cause more harm. Again, if you're having atrial fibrillation, then we do know that you have 7 times the risk of the normal population of having a stroke, so you'd need to be covered. Those are things that plant-based nutrition can't tackle. But, you know, certainly if you're on the warfarin or Coumadin medication and people tell you not to eat greens, that's malarkey. You eat the greens to stay healthy, and your blood thinners are adjusted accordingly. The newer blood thinners, unfortunately, they're more expensive, but you don't have to worry about any dietary involvement in the blood levels. So, you know, you need to be your own advocate with your healthcare providers. And we certainly provide consultations to people that want to kind of just have a second opinion or, you know, want to look into somebody that's willing to take them off their medications. There was a study just published in the Journal of American Medical Association that looked at the new PCSK8 inhibitors, you know, that lowers LDL cholesterol. And it's like, well, you know, there's less events after somebody's had a heart attack, then there's less recurrent events if they take this drug that's very expensive with injections every month than just taking a high-dose statin. But what they didn't mention was there were actually more deaths in the group that took the injectable drugs than in the just statin drugs. So, you know, what good does it do to have less heart attacks if you're going to have an increased death rate? You know, maybe it wasn't statistically significant, but what I saw in that study was that they were still having significant events where they've taken high-dose statins or high-dose statins plus a PCSK8 inhibitor. So, you know, do your homework, ask questions. There's nobody that we haven't been able to get their cholesterol under control through plant-based nutrition. Some people are harder than others. Some people really have to be diligent about staying away from nuts and oil and exercising and looking. You know, it's difficult for them to eat out, but it certainly can be done. And most people get really, really good results. Sometimes it takes longer than others, but they're still protected because they're not eating these bad things that oxidize the cholesterol that cause harm. And we certainly have people with heart disease in our practice, but they're not having chest pain and events. So I'm very happy about that. I'm also happy to report that I've had my first patient in the practice that actually had a heart transplant. It's like, well, geez, that's nothing to brag about. You said plant-based nutrition reversed disease. This person had an idiopathic, meaning we don't know why, cardiomyopathy, and he came to me because he was very much overweight and had a history of diabetes and cancer, and he wasn't going to be a heart transplant candidate. And through plant-based nutrition, he was able to lose a significant amount of weight. And he was ultimately put on the transplant list and received a heart transplant and is doing well. So hats off to him. And obviously he'll continue plant-based nutrition to stay healthy and to decrease the risk of rejection with his new heart. Because again, plant-based nutrition is going to improve his immune function, improve his microbiome. It's going to improve the blood vessels throughout his body. Decreases risk of recurrent cancer, decreases risk of diabetes, help him maintain his weight. So, you know, it may not have prevented, he wasn't, he, you know, when he had his cardiomyopathy, he became plant-based later. Would it have prevented it? Nobody knows, but certainly it can help him in the future with his new heart. And there's, you know, no better gift in the world than somebody donating their heart. So you have to take good care of it. So next week we'll be heading up to, again, Washington, D.C., to the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. I'll be meeting Addie up there, Delaney Meinrich. Please, I almost forgot one of the most important things today. Next month is my birthday, and I'm not usually real excited about my birthday because it's usually the end of summer, but down here in Florida, it's never the end of summer, so that's not so bad either. But we're going to have a challenge. In our practice, we have wellness challenges every month that Addie directs, and we decided that we could involve all of you if you'd like. So, you know, we want to have a Plan Strong Movement Matters month. And so, again, our dietitian usually creates a movement, but this year we're going to do a movement minutes. So if y'all want to participate, you can. It's to show how much you're moving, so you can send a photo of your fitness watch or smartphone exercise to my Jamila Delaney MD Facebook page. We're looking to see how much people exercise in session minutes, not daily steps. I mean, steps are great, but we want to know just, you know, how much you're cranking out at a time. We want you to document it just to keep everybody a little bit honest. And you're going to enter to do this. So it's going to an entrance fee of $29 in the month of August, which you can go to the website, drdelaney.com. That's drdelaney. And we'll send you a t-shirt in the appropriate size, men or women's, you can designate, and you'll be entered in to list what you're doing for exercise. The person that has the most time logged will get a new plant-based wellness cookbook, Three Generations of Cooking with the Doctor, the Dietitian, and the Diva. And as a bonus, anybody that entered into the challenge will have the ability to win a drawing where you get two nutrition coaching calls with Addie Delaney Meinrich. If you're a member of the practice, you can enter for free, and you can actually donate your sessions to somebody else if you'd like. You have to be registered by August the 1st, and we want you to log your sessions on the Facebook page, and this is all described if you've in a newsletter, and it'll be described on the Facebook page. But we want you to put everything in by Monday to get credit for it, so we don't have it dragging in throughout the week. So every Monday you'll put your exercise documentation, and you know, if it's after Monday, then so be it. If you have any questions after you've seen this, you can email me at info@drdelaney.com. It's spelled out again, DocTorDelaney. Go to the website to register. You can go to the website and click on Dr. Delaney's birthday challenge to read all this. We like to get as many people. I hope I have to order more shirts, get people exercising, and you can take some selfies and post it on the website. Love to see, love to hear from you. And it'll be a month where we can all get healthy and in shape together. So help me celebrate movement and exercise and health and wellness by joining our challenge. And you can wear your Jamie Delaney shirt proudly. So our heart beats on plants. I hope yours does too. I'll speak to you next week and give you highlights of what we've learned at the conference. Have a great week.